Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now for one of our conversations with leading strategists and thinkers is Dr. Hans Christian Hagmann, one of the world's sharpest strategy minds. He's the chief analyst and senior advisor to Sweden's State Secretary for Foreign Affairs at the Swedish Ministry for Foreign Affairs, where he leads the policy planning, strategy, and foresight team. His views expressed today are his own. Hans, thanks so very much for joining us.
My pleasure. It's always fun to talk to you, sir.
It's an honor and pleasure. The conversation is sponsored by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems and devoted to the memory of one of America's greatest national security strategists, Andy Marshall, the late, great, former director of the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology, and Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our air and missile defense coverage. Hans, you're not just a strategist, but you're also a thinker on strategy. And we're in an extraordinary period, right? Proliferation of technology is fundamentally changing the balance of power. During the Cold War, the Soviet Union was trapped in an economically doomed system that separated it from the West, whereas China and Russia now benefit from cutting-edge technologies and actually live in free and open markets, while at the same time becoming economically and militarily powerful enough to intimidate their neighbors, and indeed not just their neighbors, right? I mean, have global reach in their ability to pose headaches. In the midst of this, they're selling this vision of authoritarian nations are superior to democracies, and look how how badly the democracies performed during this COVID crisis, whether it's the United States, whether it's Europe, and indeed I'll say even Sweden. But before we get to the pandemic, because I want to get your views on how that strategically changed the ballgame, the broader issue this is highlighting is this concern that great nations and great democracies are no longer as strategic as they need to be, right? I mean, some people look at the Brexit decision and say it was a demonstration of democracy, but an astrategic maneuver for a great power to make. You know, and certainly that debate is happening in the United States, that America used to be very, very good at doing big things very well and now can't even do little things well. Or necessary things well. What is the essence of strategy, and what's the key to getting it right?
Well, thanks. I mean, that's quite a question to start with. But I would say that the essence of strategy is having a clear perception of where you are today, what the challenges, the interests, the threats. You know your enemy, know yourself. In 100 battles, you'll never be in peril. So you have to understand your own strengths and weaknesses, and everybody else's strengths and weaknesses. And then you have a vision where you want to be in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, how to protect our way of life, how to be able to maintain the standards that we want. So essentially a perspective for our kids and grandchildren. So then the strategy is going from today's reality, over, under, together, with, instead of, in order to reach the vision. And the strategy will be very political because it will demand resources. It'll demand especially priorities. It will demand who do we work with? Who do we compromise with? And that is the very essence of strategy, the whole step from A to B. But I would like to add that we have been spoiled in the past, I would say almost 100 years, where we've had the privilege of U.S. dominance and U.S. leadership. And thanks to U.S. dominance, we shouldn't forget that in the 50s, 3/4 of all manufacturing in the world came from the United States. Of the whole world's manufacturing. I mean, that is staggering. And during the Eisenhower era, I mean, the U.S. Percentage of GDP was almost 50%. And that is huge. So of course, that if you have a country such as the U.S., which is so big, so dominant, but also a leader when it comes to democracy, when it comes to global institutions, when it comes to development aid, when it comes to investments, when it comes to innovation especially, then of course it's quite easy for all of us in the West to follow that lead because it's all for the greater good. And to be honest, the global institutions, the multilateral institutions, were created by the U.S. in a very enlightened, open and inclusive way. However, today, it is a fact that the US is only 16% of global GDP in PPP terms, and China is somewhere around 18.6%, according to the IMF. Those are today's numbers. And it's a fact that China is a bigger economy than the US since about 2014. So from 1872 to 2014, the US was number one and entirely dominant. And it's a fact today that China today represents 43.4% of all patent applications. And the US is at 19% of that total, and Europe even further down the road. And this really does change when a really big country such as China, which has four times the US population, of course, that will have a bigger impact. And as Hugh White, the brilliant Australian strategist, says that when the average Chinese worker is half as productive as the average American worker, well, then the Chinese economy will be twice as big as the US economy. So, yes, you do have internal challenges with China and the corruption and the challenges, but size does matter. And China and India, but also Brazil, Indonesia, Mexico, and others will have a bigger say tomorrow. And that won't make it easier for us.
How do we need, right? I mean, so obviously strategy and getting it right is much more acute, right? I mean, we in the United States tend to be sloppy because we've always been the top dog, and there's this sense that we're sort of somehow morally and, you know, God is gracing us with this greatness, and it's sort of unsquanderable, right? I mean, that's always the trick and the challenge for the leading power, right? I mean, leading powers get complacent, whereas smaller powers, for example, Sweden needs to be strategic all the time because a screw up is really, you know, you don't have as much margin at the end of the day to play with. How do we need to think about the period that we are in? Because as you said, the United States has tried, at least it does muscle allies and partners around, right? But as a general rule, the United States is pretty transparent, is committed to the global rules of the order, constrains itself based on rules that it's agreed to, whereas China is a completely different ballgame. It shuns the rules, said I wasn't part of their crafting, and so I will redo the world order, and it will take us back to what it views to be the historically correct. Might makes right. I'm big. I get to make the rules, and you're little, and you're just a little red dot, right? How do we need to think about where we are and where we're going if we collectively are going to remain in a sort of rules-based global order?
Sure. Now, I think that's a highly relevant question. But in order to shift priorities and to essentially shift strategy, you need a sense of urgency. You need some kind of wake-up call. And I would like to see that, for example, in the first the global financial crisis of 2008, which, interestingly enough, the Asians say, no, that wasn't a global financial crisis. That was the transatlantic financial crisis. But then today we have the COVID crisis, which is really, really dramatic. I mean, global trade decreased 8.5% last year. So, I mean, this should be the catalyst to change and shift priorities. But what that calls for is, I think, very much being realistic as well. There's some things we can change, and we can shift around, but we will not be able to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. It was the golden age when the US and the West could dominate in the way it did. I don't think that time is coming back. I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I think we have to be realistic that there are other countries out there who are really big, and they want a seat at the table, and they want to be heard. And even countries such as India, which I'm a huge fan of, however, their view on equality, their view on sustainability, on the environment, and so forth, is perhaps not identical to the view which we have in large parts of Europe. So even if they're a democracy, they have different priorities, different interests, and we have to be humble enough to accept that, okay, in a zero-sum game, others will have more to say, which means that we will have to be more selective, which are the must-have elements, which are the nice-to-have elements in the global order. And I do see that the U.S. has an advantage by having so many allies, and everybody wants to be friends with the U.S. I wouldn't say everybody, but a large chunk of the world's countries. We're talking about maybe 50 countries who really want to be close to the U.S. And that is a fantastic asset. But that demands that the U.S. is willing to compromise. And that's not easy. It's easy to say we can cooperate and coordinate with each other. But when I bring back to my government, well, that means that we have to compromise. Uh-oh, that's not as easy to sell within a government vis-a-vis Congress and or parliaments. That's more difficult to compromise on your own standards and ambitions for the greater good. But that is essentially what we have to do in today's situation so that we especially can convince the countries who are sitting on the fence, so to say, who are part of the Belt Road Initiative, but they want to become more democratic. They want good relations with the U.S. We need to prove that the democratic system we have delivers the goods, that it produces more stable societies, that it produces more prosperity, that it produces more creativity and innovation and the best and the most brilliant technology, and that we can fight wars, not just with legacy capabilities, but also tomorrow's warfare in the high-tech sphere. So we need to make a case that, hey, guys, if you're sitting on the fence, you know, join our side, become like us, because you don't want to become the alternative. And that's not easy when the democratic trends have been negative. And actually, it's just 8.4% of the world's population live in full democracies, according to The Economist, and less than 50% live in flawed or full democracies in the world. And that's quite painful. So we have a lot of work to do, but we do need a lot of humility. So I'm quite optimistic with a lot of the messaging from the Biden administration, who come in into government with a relatively realistic perspective. And I think that's helpful in today's world.
One of the things, right, I mean, at the end of the day, it is about prioritization. But there's also a concern, right? I mean, even though there is this optimism about the Biden administration, there's this lingering view that what we experienced 4 years ago could happen again in the future, and that the United States may not be as reliable and stable a partner, right? I mean, once was a time when we didn't 180 degrees change among administrations or between administrations, whereas now there seems to be a case, you know, we're out of the Iran deal, we're back in the Iran deal, we're off completely in climate, we're back into climate. And so it's not unrealistic that if a Republican president is elected in 4 years' time, that Republican president will pull the plug on everything again, given the outlook for the party. And then we had the January 6th event, right? I mean, you're talking about the importance of democracies and acting well. And then now the pandemic stuff, which shows that the EU can't really move the way that it should, right? I mean, the timing is awful in the wake of Brexit, where Britain has managed to put lots of shots in arms situation in Europe isn't improving. What signals do these send? And how do governments need to respond? Not to put you on the spot, Hans, right? I mean, but I think, you know, even good Swedish friends of mine acknowledge that Sweden could have done a better job ultimately at this.
Sure.
Right. How do democracies get around this at a time when the authoritarians are making the message, listen, these democracies don't know what they're doing. Trust us. You'll have less freedom, but you'll be better run, which works in a lot of places of the world, including Singapore, right? Where you can live large, you know, very, very freely. But it's not quite a democracy.
That's very true. And it pains me that we have rather missed this opportunity. I mean, with COVID, which is a global threat. It doesn't come from any one country. SARS came from it was Singapore and Hong Kong. Ebola came from Africa. So pandemics are truly global in that case. And we've really missed an opportunity here to find a common purpose and to at least temporarily lay down our arms when it comes to ideology when it comes to territorial integrity and security issues, and say that, at least within this area, let's work really close together. And we have a dramatic rise in health nationalism, and that is not helpful. We've felt it extremely painful here in Europe as well. But to get to your real point is our market value isn't great right now, either in Europe or in the US, or I would add even China. A lot of us have lost a lot of soft power. And of course, the January 6th storming of the Capitol was not good for the US image, or the US leaving arms control regimes, or going it alone, or dropping out of the Paris Accord, and things which are quite important to many others in the world. That has not been beneficial for transatlantic relations or the US standing in the world. So essentially, and I would say the same goes for Europe, with Brexit and with our internal challenges. And it is true. I mean, it is a peace project, and it's not always pretty when 27 sovereign states try to coordinate and get their act together, because our threat perceptions are very different from Portugal to Poland, or from Sweden to Ireland, or to Greece and Italy. It varies quite a lot, which is natural. But it's better that we work together and communicate within a family than we go back to the bad old days, which is conflict and terrible loss on all parameters. So we have survived Europe through this pandemic. It has not collapsed, and Brexit hasn't had a knock-on effect on other countries wanting to leave the EU, which is good. But there's still a fact that in large parts of the world, the EU is not seen as a strategic player, which, in fairness, it is not when it comes to the military. The EU does not have its own brigades or carrier battle groups and so forth. But the EU is a strategic player when it comes to norms, standards, and trade. And it sounds terrible, but the EU bureaucracy is actually one of its superpowers. That, I mean, send in the suits from Brussels, and they're a formidable force. I mean, the way that Gazprom was broken up a few years ago, previously they had a monopoly on everything from the extraction to the final delivery and everything in between, and that was divided up. And that's something which divisions could not perform in that way,
right,
but the EU bureaucracy could. So there's an openness there, but it is a problem that we are not seen as leaders in all senses. Even on democracy, it's been sliding. Even in the US, even in Europe, it's been sliding, unfortunately.
What are the key lessons, Hans, from your perspective, from the pandemic? Is it a reminder of time being precious, right? I mean, if you know, it's the only irreplaceable commodity, right? At the end of the day, if you didn't act early enough, you didn't prepare early enough, you can't, it's very, very expensive to buy any of that back.
Yeah.
What are some of the broader lessons from your standpoint? And what's the changed landscape coming out of this, right? Because you wrote an absolutely fascinating paper on how to think about this, because we know those of us who are vaccinated, we're like, hooray. And you put, I think, a very interesting sort of coda on this, that it actually may not be over for a while, right? You may want to get back to normal. You may not be able to get back to normal. Give us a sense for the dynamic, where we are and where we're going, you think.
Sure. As human beings, as our species, we have to see the world as the glass half full. There has to be an optimism. We have to look forward, and we want to look to what's best for our kids and grandkids and so forth. It's in our very nature. But it is a fact that the pandemic will be with us for many, many years. And it's actually a race between how quickly you get the world vaccinated, the world, nota bene, and the rate of mutations. And it's everything from the Indian double mutations to the British variant to the South African variant and so forth. And it is a fact that the vaccination rate is not up to the level which it needs to be. by today's vaccination standards, which is about slightly less than 20 million doses per day globally, it'll take about 3 years to cover 75% of the world's population with a two-dose vaccine. And 3 years is a long time when we're talking about mutating viruses. And that's what viruses do. They mutate. It's what they do. Just as much as mothers love their kids, viruses mutate. And the problem is that, I mean, just take a country such as Ghana, which was the first country to receive the COVAX vaccination support, the global COVAX support. And in their best case scenario, they will be vaccinating 2 million people by the end of 2021. However, Ghana is a country of 32.5 million people. So in a best case scenario, they will be vaccinating 6% of the population. But since then, we've had some issues with export restrictions from India on vaccines. So we don't really know if they'll be able to even make the 6% number. And the same goes for Kenya. I saw an article just the other day that their hopes are to inoculate 30% of its population by mid-2023, if all goes well. And it's great that the United States is getting vaccinated. And we're moving there in Europe as well, slower than the US, slower than Israel, definitely slower than the UAE, slower than the UK. But we're getting there. But increasingly, when I speak to chief scientists around the world, not least in Asia, they're saying that they're talking about having restrictions absolutely until 2024. And that we will probably need a booster shot once every 6 months. I'll not identify which government it is, which is already planning for that. But I think that we need a mental preparedness that things will not just bounce back. And what kind of bubbles will we have? When will the flow of business travel, which is down 90% last year, when will that get back? And even regular flights, air travel has gone down 65% last year. Now that's a lot. It's just essentially maintained by domestic flights in the US and China. So this is huge, but it is really problematic. And what kind of vaccine passes? How do we secure them? What do we do with fakes? What do we do with cyber attacks on them? This is not easy. And where do you put the level of trust? And I fear that unless we're super brilliant and we are lucky that the virus mutates towards just kinder, gentler, less virulent versions, and it may probably die out after 4, 5, 6 years, as most viruses do, then they may pop up again after 10 or 20 years, as we've seen before. But it may be a very different world. And the consequences of this, I mean, is that diplomacy is much more difficult today when you do it because you miss all the fine details, all the nuances, and you miss all the trust which you have when you sit across somebody with a cup of coffee or over a beer or a breakfast croissant which crumbles on your tie. That's what you need. You need that closeness. You need trust. Even in new business deals, I mean, you can maintain business via Zoom and Skype and telefaxes and so forth. But new deals, you really want to meet people and see them between four eyes and have a sturdy handshake because it's a matter of trust. So I fear that there will be long-term and quite dramatic consequences. And then we haven't even mentioned the mental health issue or the cost of healthcare booming or the whole issue of debt, where a lot of countries are taking on a lot of debt and many will not be able to repay it. About 35 countries in Africa are essentially on the verge of going bankrupt. What happens if they do default? One or two or three, probably not a problem. But if it's 10 or 20, and we're talking about hundreds of millions of people, then all of a sudden that is a global issue. And then that's a concern for the major banks. So we're not quite out of the woods yet. And I wish I could be a bit more optimistic, but I do see that we really need to work together and take down our guard and say, whatever smart ideas you guys have in your labs, hey, send them over to us and so we can stand on each other's shoulders and work together. But that's not easy in times of great power competition to do that. And it's really, really sad that we're not in that stage and we've missed this opportunity. Sorry, that was a long answer, but it was a really interesting question.
It was a very interesting answer, Hans. I want to take, I want to go to Russia and China in a moment and get your thoughts on both of those. But first, you have a military background. So you're not just some PhD academic in war studies who gazes at his navel all the time. You know about the practicalities of these things in the history of warfare. How is the nature of conflict changing? If you look at how China and Russia are prosecuting use of force, achieving national means and ends, we have been in a hot cyber war for a long time. Unrecognized, I think, widely. We see SolarWinds and the Microsoft hacks and a couple of OPM in the United States. Sweden has dealt with some of these intrusions as well. Russia is expert at using disinformation as a strategic weapon. You can see what happened in meddling in U.S. elections, one of which, and several of which, in fact, may have proven remarkably successful. China uses economic power, particularly against smaller countries. I want to get talk to you a little bit about that, about how small countries can stand up to a China, that can cut off pork or do what it's doing to Australia. How is the use of force changing, and how do we need to think differently? Because absent dramatically better agility, across all of these vectors, we're in trouble. How do we need to think about how the use of force, coercion is changing? Because our notion of this sort of, there will be a great battle, there may not be a great battle. And if you're China and you believe in Sun Tzu, you want to win without fighting at all, right? I mean, that's the most wasteful way of going about it.
Just to start off where you ended there, I think that a really good start is just to go back to the classics. Read Sun Tzu, not just a quote or two, but to really get into the thinking of that. To be honest, I think that when we look at the nature of conflict, I think it's very much a case of going back to basics. All is fair in love and war. The meaning, getting back to strategy, a nation, you have to use all assets at your disposal. And it's not just the military. It is economic. It is social cohesion. It is critical infrastructure. It is standards and norms and long-term competitiveness, because somebody has to pull in the money for the state. I'm a civil servant such as I. We just cost money. So we need a vibrant industry, which is competitive, globally competitive, in order to be able to fund all the good stuff which we want. But so I would see that it is less of how we use force, but how we use power. And how do we define power? Getting back to basics, I see power, who has the data? Who has the investments? Because if you come with a big bag of money and you're prepared to invest, well, that opens doors. Now that's one form of power. The same goes for development aid. That is a form of power. Now, definitely the military has a large role to play here, although many European countries are perhaps postmodern, or they like to see themselves as postmodern, like we're beyond the hard security. It is a fact that for most countries in the world, hard security is really, really important. And so, of course, if you have care about groups, or if you have nukes, or if you have ballistic missiles, or especially if you have a competent cyber capability, that does play a lot. But other elements which are power, I mean, is the softer elements of power, the ability to convene, to argue, to take the long-term perspective and so forth. So there, even smaller countries can play a role when it's not just the size of your economy or the size of your population or the size of your military. So it all does add up there. But let me just get back to what, if we then talk about force in a more traditional sense, how do you impact a country? Well, you need to use all the means at your disposal. And there I fear that we're sometimes a bit too conservative, if I may use that word, when it comes to our defenses. We all have large defense industries. We all have large interests in these. We have proud regiments and brigades and battalions and fantastic ships. And we like our kit. And definitely it's important if you have a frigate to use it. And it's a formidable force when you place that in somebody else's harbor or an aircraft carrier on the horizon. Definitely. But there is a tendency to focus on things rather than outputs and capabilities. And if you want to influence today's economies, then I think that cybersecurity and cyber defense and even the offense is really, really important. And I do believe that people like General Cartwright are spot on when they talk about, you know, a billion cyber attacks within the first nanoseconds of a war. And then, you know, a couple of million targets need to be hit kinetically within 100 minutes. And that's a very different kind of warfare than the one where we note that something's happened and then we wait for the next government meeting in a week's time and we formulate a communique and then it goes back and forth a few months until we have escalated. And I fear that incidents such as, I mean, new P3 incident, which we had in March 2001, if we would have that today, when China's economy is literally 8 times bigger than it was then, it's a different ballgame. It's much more dangerous. And that worries me that we are overestimating our own capabilities and underestimating our opponent's capabilities. Going back to Sun Tzu, what is happening even as we speak? What is the targeting? What is the penetration of our open societies, of our digital systems? That worries me much more than whether or not we have the next aircraft carrier doing a phone op in the South China Sea, for example.
I couldn't agree with you more, Hans. And right, if you think through the problem, right, you could argue actually that not many countries are responding the way that they should, right? The responses are very, very classical. I think the, you know, F-35 is a great platform, just like I think the new Gripen is a tremendous aircraft, and the A-26 will be a tremendous asset to the Swedish state, as well as to all of Sweden's allies and partners, even the United States at the end of the day. As a capability. But, you know, you wonder whether or not we're making those right kinds of investments in the face of what China is doing, for example, in anti-access area denial capabilities investment, right? During the Cold War, we were giving aid to Africa at the height of a battle where we were trying to win hearts, minds, influence, votes in the United Nations. And again, in China's case, you have an integrated, very thoughtful strategy that prioritizes resources and happens to have a lot of them. How, you know, you mentioned China and your concern about what an incident looks like. How do we need to think about China? Because China's most vexing attribute is not just its military power, which is increasingly impressive, but its ability to punish and a track record of punishment. You know, I mentioned Australia, for example, and Australia has been punished. The European view, and indeed, I would say right after the cathartic and stunning death of Saab, I have to say, as a Saab car fan, I mean, it was a very dark and sad day for Trollhättan to close. The Chinese were interested in buying it. It ended up being like, no, we don't want it to happen. And then when it was about to happen to Volvo, everybody was like, good God, let's Geely in here and save the country, company. And at the end of the day was, hey, there's no piper to be paid. Well, now there appears to be a piper to be paid. How do we need to think about countering China and its influence, deterring better as a global community, right? Empowered by Hong Kong, there's a lot of worry here that China will move against Taiwan in one form or another, whether it's a soft takeover or a hard takeover. And how do small countries stand up to such a massive country at the end of the day that can exact a lot of economic pain?
Yeah. I mean, that is really the $64,000 question It is really, really difficult because we are in a globalized world where we are all dependent on each other, more or less. And it is a fact that, for example, China has invested heavily in Sweden, and it's been very good for Swedish business, for the Swedish country, for the Swedish taxpayer. And it's so far so good. And we all have a lot of business in China. I mean, do not forget that even the U.S., you export for $125 billion a year to China. That's a lot. Yes, you export more to Canada and Mexico, but China is up there and really important for the U.S. And actually, it is slightly more important to Sweden than it was, and most European countries, than the U.S. is nowadays, which is not that strange because it is a very big market and a lot of people. And GDP per capita has increased. But how do we stand up? That's the key question. Luckily, in Europe, we do have the European Union. And again, I do see that when it comes to countering Russia or China, the EU is a pretty good place to start. And I would argue that we in the West, whether it's the EU or it's Japan or the US or Australia or even India, I mean, as sovereign countries, or in our case, a union, we are able to decide everything we produce, import, or export, what standard that should have when it comes to child labor, when it comes to, you know, chemicals and food, when it comes to, well, whatever. We can put whatever standard we want. And it does have a price if we say that, no, we do not want our clothes produced by A, B, and C, and we set standards. Well, that means that, okay, it'll be tough for a couple of countries, not just China, but also in Africa or others who maybe are not up to that standard. And it will be more expensive for our consumers to buy the higher quality of product A, B, or C, which doesn't contain the badness. But I believe that we are such a large market in the EU, it's 460 million people, and you're a fair-sized market as well in the US. And if we get Japan on board, hey, that's pretty interesting. And we did this. Europe and Japan went together a couple of years ago and decided and agreed on certain standards when it came to the automobile industry, when it came to exhausts and car safety, for example. And that became de facto the global standard because it's too expensive for either US car makers or Chinese car makers to have double standards. So, well, okay, you take the majority kind of. And if the US, the EU, and Japan especially, get together and set a number of standards, that is a very soft way of forcing other countries to comply with those standards. That's, sorry, we do not want child labor, and we cannot maybe stop it in all places, but we can definitely decide what we want to import into our economies, and we can definitely decide what kind of standards we want to export. So in a sense, it may sound a bit defensive, but go by the book, and the best case scenario is actually if we get China on board on some of these standards. And yes, maybe be making deals with somebody else, but I think we really need to get China on board when it comes to, for example, climate change, when it comes to ocean management, when it comes to managing space. The more dialogue we have with them, the more important. And we should not just let these spheres be entirely nationalized or militarized. That will not be good with multiple standards. So it may be a bureaucratic answer, but I really do believe that we can do a lot if we gang together, because then it is critical mass. But alone, we're toast.
Are there weaknesses of that system that can be exploited, right? Because the government is not as popular with the people, especially as it's become more authoritarian at the end of the day. There's a lot of brittleness. A lot of the best and brightest were going back to China, where they could get investment capital and start businesses after their blue chip education, whether it was at Chalmers or at MIT or anywhere else. Whereas now, you know, Chinese entrepreneurs, some of whom I know, They're not that crazy about going back to China because they may never be able to leave China again, right? Mm. I mean, everybody sees what happened, for example, to Jack Ma as a prominent example. Do you see strategic weakness, and how is it both an opportunity but also a danger, right? Because as authoritarian countries, as we see with Russia, they can lash out externally, especially if they feel like they're under pressure at home.
Sure. I must admit that I see considerable vulnerabilities and fragilities in most of our countries, China including. The Communist Party in China has 93 million members. So it's not just a small group, it's quite a significant group which have long-term interests in this. And I think it's interesting to see which is most important for the current Secretary General, Xi Jinping. Is it growth? Is it control? Or is it security? And it's probably all of the three, yes. But control seems to be more important today than it was a few years ago. Status has always been important, but maybe growth is not the top priority as we would see it. But I think that is a flaw of us, that we are not as empathetic because we apply our standards, our norms, our perspective on China. And therefore, I think it's very interesting to talk China with our friends in South Korea, in Japan, in Singapore, in Indonesia, to get a more domestic or regional perspective on some of the domestic elements in China. But yes, I do see that there are certain challenges which China has. We would lift, human rights, we would lift corruption, we would lift dependence on external natural resources and so forth. But China's not alone in this. I mean, take Japan, which is extremely dependent on external resources and aging populations and so forth. But China is such a big player today that whatever happens, if it flourishes, if it stabilizes, if it's prosperous, if it's happy, or if it has overcapacity or irrationalities, as I would say, then it is all of a sudden a global challenge because it is such a big and important player. Just as if the US has hiccups, well, it does have an impact globally. And the same goes for China. And my scenario, which I just wonder, and I'm barely dare talk about it, but is China too big to fail? What would happen if China would have internal challenges or economic hiccups, which maybe wouldn't be hiccups, but crises? So far, we haven't seen them because the Communist Party understands that their survivability depends on people, having better. But it is a really big and important country to follow in every shape and form. And they will have a bigger say in the world. I think that we should take that for granted. But that does not mean that it will be hegemonic. And that is one sad case, or just maybe just realistic case, that today we have no one global leader. Getting back to COVID, that the US is not all dominant. Europe is definitely not all dominant. Neither is China. Definitely not India, nor Brazil, nor Mexico, Indonesia, or some of the other bigger players. And this is the challenge that for all the big major problems in the world, we need to work together. And this is really, really politically painful. How do we work with China on one hand? I think the Biden administration is actually trying to do this. And it'd be really interesting if they manage to square the circle here, that you can have confrontation on one level and you can have cooperation on another set of issues without those getting entirely entangled like spaghetti. But it's not easy. But China is a feature and it has ambitions and it is a fact of life. So let's not try to go back to the good old days. It is a fact, but I'm much more worried about a China in crisis than a China which is cocky or prosperous or globally active, because that at least means that we have some understanding of their trajectory. So a failing China is definitely not what we want. We don't want a failing India or the US either, to be honest. But China is somewhat of an enigma. Yes.
We, Hans, we've got a couple of minutes left, and I want to ask you first about Russia, a nation with which Sweden has had an interesting and exceptionally long history with. Putin has become bellicose, again, raising tensions on the Ukraine border, making the case that his administration is morally superior from your, you know, and just extraordinarily successful, obviously, at the disinformation game globally and using all the tools at his disposal expertly. How do we need to think about Russia in this period?
We are sometimes tempted to look at a map and see how huge Russia is. Russia is a huge, huge country, and it is important. It has a lot of nukes. It has quite high ambitions. But to be honest, even with their defense increases, there's still a fraction of Europe's defense investments or Europe's combined defense investments. They have quite limited development aid, relatively limited investments in other countries. So it's from a relatively weak position, it's getting quite a lot of good attention from it. But Russia has a relatively undiversified economy. It has issues with corruption, and it has broken international laws and norms. And whether it's the annexation of the Crimea or the Ukraine or aggression vis-a-vis neighbors, its relation with China is problematic and quite sad, because I have an enormous respect for Russian culture. And I would want to see Russia invest more in itself, in education, in R&D, in diversifying its economy. I mean, who will want Russian oil and gas in 50 years' time? And it's still a very, very big country, and they have a significant military force. But it is a challenge for all of its neighbors. And I would see the whole Baltic Sea area is neighbor to Russia, and it is a really important player. But we should not cut Russia off. We need dialogue. We need to understand. You need to understand their priorities. So you just can't ignore them. Definitely not. But we need to maintain dialogue.
The Biden administration is withdrawing from Afghanistan. Obviously, Swedish forces participated in this 20-year-long mission. Does this send the world a very negative sign?
To a degree, it sends a realistic signal. And I think it's a fact of life that there are limits to our abilities to change societies. We can try to help. We can try to assist. But we just can't convert everything and make everything into a mini US or a mini Sweden. But it does send a signal that things have changed. But I'm not quite sure that we've managed Afghanistan that much better 30 years ago or 40 years ago. And we know the experience which Soviet Union had. It is difficult to try to change a country. And Afghanistan was one of the poorest countries in the world. And a lot of good has been done. Look how many are going to school. Look what kind of development projects we have. Their roads, their infrastructure. So there is hope. There's a lot of dark clouds on the horizon, yes, but there is hope.
And so the answer might be to do continued investment, for example, even if military capability is not on the ground.
I would say definitely. I mean, Afghanistan is still an important country, strategically placed, and it needs help from the rest of the world. And that's from India to Europe to the US. But as most countries, you don't want them to fail, because then you'll have even bigger problems. But it is a question of cost benefits. And is it the country which needs the most help? It's up there, definitely. But it's not the only country in the world which needs help, stabilization, investments, development aid, so forth.
Let me ask you one last question. And that's, how do we, if we're not investing in the right kind of military capabilities, what do we need to do to get better at this, right? Because there's a lot of inertia, but unfortunately, there also isn't a lot of time for us to adapt if we're going to keep militarily deterring, whether it's Russia, but particularly China. Do we need to think of military capabilities in a different way? And if so, how?
I think we definitely need to think about military capabilities. I mean, Sweden is increasing its defense budget by 40% over the next 5 years, which is quite significant. But it's important, what do we focus that kind of investment on, what kind of capabilities, and how do you fight wars? I think we really need to get back to which are our own vulnerabilities. A lot more red teaming. We need a lot more scenarios. We need war gaming to a much higher degree than we have today, not least in Europe. That what are our fragilities? if you were an attacker, how would you want to impact governments, credibility of the states, of infrastructure, of, well, all elements of security in order to gain an advantage or have an impact. So we need to look very closely at ourselves and our own vulnerabilities. And that is one of the biggest challenges. How do we develop technology in democracies when a lot of the technologies have been used in, well, quite challenging ways by authoritarian states? So this is, we need technology, we need to be creative, but there are flip sides to most elements, not least technology. But the more we cooperate, the better, I think. And there we need to lower our threshold to cooperation across the Atlantic and among trusted allies. And so that we have firewalls around our cooperations. But we really do need to work together. If we do it alone, we are just too small and will not have a significant impact. So the more cooperation, the better across the Atlantic, I think is a pretty sound advice. Don't go it alone, US, don't go it alone, Europe, definitely not for the for Japan or Australia either.
Hans, thanks so much for joining us. It's always an honor and pleasure. Already looking forward to welcoming you back on again. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, sir. It's been excellent. Thank you very much. Very interesting.